Hello and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me usual is Rich. Hello, Rich.
What is going on?
Oh, not a whole lot. You know, it's kind of the dead point of the NBA season. You know, we're in that transition between the 2018 and 2019 NBA seasons. Most of the big free agent news has happened. You know, you might get a August trade here, coming up. You know, there's always seems to be like a weird trade in August that is a big deal. But outside of that, not much happening in the real NBA. But in our 20 years ago NBA universe, there's quite a bit going on.
Yeah, things are popping quite a bit here. The our actual world is slowing down a little bit for the next, month or so. As you said, there's probably going to be one more trade that kind of surprises us, but for other purposes, basically got about a month or so until things kind of slow down a little bit and training camps get going or whatnot. But man, things are hot and heavy 20 years ago, man. There is a lot going down right now.
Absolutely. So we're a little behind on our 20 years ago tracking. So we got busy, had some vacations, some things happened. So we're going to cover quite a bit of ground here. We're going to start with the...
Trapped in Casablanca for like 5 days or something. I mean, you couldn't get home. Trying to get home, yeah. Trying to do this podcast. You're like, people, I need to get on that plane. Right. I got to talk about the NBA 20 years ago.
Yeah, like, that's how I talked myself onto that last plane, was I had to do a podcast. That's exactly
right.
No, but we're starting with the we're done with the NBA playoffs. We're going to reach up until the point where free agency will begin, or will it? That's the dum-dum-dum. That's the question. Yes. So, but we'll start with the playoffs and we'll see where we get. So, and we will start with the first round, of course, which is the place that you would start the playoffs with the battle of the 4 versus 5 seed, the Charlotte Hornets taking on the Atlanta Hawks, and Charlotte won that series 3-1. This is back, of course, when we are still in best of five first rounds.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting series because you have the Hornets who are kind of ebbing and flowing a little bit. They've gone through some, drastic changes over the last few years in terms of moving away from your Alonzo Mournings and moving away from your Larry Johnsons and going more towards the Anthony Masons, the Glenn Rices, that sort of next generation of the Hornets. And the Hawks are actually, we're going to talk about them a lot on this. They're a surprisingly competent team at this point. I mean, obviously they lose this round and that's kind of disappointing, but I mean, we're in the midst of like one of the, it was brief, but it was kind of a Hawks renaissance for a little bit. I mean, in the mid-90s, they were winning 50 plus games or whatever. I think this year they won about 42 or whatnot, but or 47 rather. But they're starting to get there. You're starting to see, hey, okay, we got Dikembe Mutombo, we got some things going on. So two pretty interesting teams, but match up here in a tough series for Atlanta, dropping 3-1. Most notable game, I'd say Game 4, mostly because the Hornets close out the series in the Georgia Dome after a big blowout loss in Game 3. And that Game 3 loss, the Hawks beat them 96-64, which seems like that's a hard game to come back from. And they come back, a few days later and win 91-82 to close out the series and move on to the second round. Top performer of the series, though, probably Anthony Mason. He had 23 points per game. He had 0.627 true shooting percentage, 8.3 rebounds per game, 2.8 assists per game. So Anthony Mason is doing a lot of stuff there. And interestingly enough, so the Hawks, they lose 3-1. They actually won the series on point differential, helped in large part by a 96-64 win, but a lot of the other games were close. The game one, they lost by 10. Game 2, they only lost by a handful of points. And of course, that Game 4 lost by only a little bit as well. But then that 96-64 will definitely skew the numbers a little bit there. So the Hawks on point differential should have won it, but on the court, did not, unfortunately.
Yeah, we all know the point differential is the true, arbiter right. of who should win, especially in a 4-game, sample. That obviously, is definitely scientific. It's my understanding of science is that's the way that it should work. So actually, we're going to declare Atlanta the winner of the series. They get to move on to the next round.
Right, we're going to do a butterfly effect here where we're going to basically go from every single series who won the point differential and determine the real NBA champion this year.
Exactly, yes.
Which is, of course, hopefully going to be the Atlanta Hawks, is what I'm guessing. But we'll find out.
I would guess. Yeah, that would make a lot of sense to me. Absolutely, right. Yes. So, next we have the first-seeded Chicago Bulls against the 8th-seeded New Jersey Nets. Exciting times here. And, not exactly an exciting series. The Bulls were able to sweep the Nets 3-0, of course. First two wins were fairly narrow for the Bulls, though. They only won Game 1 96-93 at home and then 96-91 at home. So the Nets were able to kind of give them a tough time at first, although the Bulls won Game 3 pretty handily there. But the Nets, Sherman Douglas, Kerry Kittles, Keith Van Horn, Jason Williams, Kendall Gill, nice little Even Ronnie Cicely, the newcomer, you know, having some minor contributions, although only played 37 minutes in the series in three games, so not doing a whole lot there. But, you know, that's all right. He's trying his hardest.
Yeah, it's an interesting series for the Nets. I mean, of course, they go down 3-0, but, you know, it's pretty fun. So before the series, I found this. It was from the New York Times article called about the NBA. It's called the NBA Playoffs, Jordan Jittery. Sure, concerned, not at all. And Jordan is asked, what would happen for the Nets to win once in this 3 out of 5 game series? What would happen for the Nets to win once, one game out of this entire series? Jordan says, we'd have to fall asleep. So not a lot of, you know, not a lot of praise there for the New Jersey Nets from old Michael Jordan. But he also says, we'd like to get this over as soon as possible, which is not great. But yeah, and then that's funny because the game one, the Nets really gave him a scare. The Bulls are pretty big. The Nets scored 27 in the fourth quarter and bring the game to overtime, which is nuts. I mean, that would have been something if the Nets had, I mean, again, butterfly effect, the Nets win the NBA championship, of course, after winning that game one. And
sure,
but no, like even then, like that's still a pretty big deal to get. And especially where we saw where the Bulls were at, you know, we'll kind of hint towards it a little bit later, but you probably know the Bulls go on and do some pretty good stuff in the rest of this playoffs. But even an extra game on a team that was really old and really injury riddled and stuff would have been, you know, pretty interesting. I'm not saying that they would have lost the NBA finals because they lost this game to the Nets, but I think it would have been kind of interesting to see them not be able to bruise through this right away. Interesting to note, this is the Nets' first playoff game since 1994, so thank God things are looking up for the New Jersey Nets. I hope this momentum carries on forever. I'm sure it will. Top performer, I mean, it's probably going to be Michael Jordan. He had 36.3 points per game on 62.1% true shooting. But I'll give the Nets a little bit of love. Sherman Douglas, you mentioned him a little bit earlier, 18.3 points per game, 8.3 assists per game. So Sherman Douglas putting up some big numbers here in the series. But ultimately, the Nets fall 3-0.
Yeah, playing big over Sam Cassell, too. Cassell barely played in the series, which is...
Right, oh, yeah. This was like the weird Sam Cassell era where he was like, I'm good, I think. And then, and he had a lot of weird stops there for a while in his career. It's interesting to see, you know, because he became such a reliable player and became such a longtime veteran presence, but there was weird stops, like, around this time. Like, obviously, he had instant success with Houston, then a little bit of issues in Dallas, couldn't quite find his footing there in New Jersey. I mean, things were real bad in New Jersey, where, like you said, you know, other guys are playing above him, and you got to imagine, you know, that he's kind of thinking, well, what the hell is going on here? But obviously, he goes to Milwaukee, and things go pretty well from there.
Right, yeah, so... Next, we have the Indiana Pacers taking on the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Pacers are the third seed. The Cavs are the sixth seed, and it's a 3-1 win for the Pacers. They handle business pretty well here. They win in a blowout in Game One in Indianapolis, and then it kind of cascades from there. The Cavs are able to pull it out in Game Three, and the other margins are, you know, only 6 points for the losses there. So it got closer from there, but not really, not really much to say about this one. Not super exciting stuff.
No, not really. The most noteworthy game I found was Game 4. Not that the game matters all that much, but I think it's pretty representative of the era because the final score was 60-74. So that's not great.
Rich, I'm 80-74, but...
Oh, wait, what did I say? 60? That would have been real bad.
It just felt like that, I'm sure, but yes.
Yeah, I'm sure. I haven't watched it, but I'm sure it felt like the Pacers only scored 60. But yeah, the Pacers win with 80-74. Sorry about that. But also interesting to note, looking in our crystal ball, this will be the last playoff game for the Cavaliers until 2006. So it'll take quite a while for them to come back. Top performer, again, we've kind of broken down this narrative many times on the straight over and back, as well as these 20 years later. But Sean Kemp was still awesome. So the narrative that he went to the Cavs and immediately started sucking is bad because he had 26 points per game and 10.3 rebounds per game. Now, things are going to get a little dicey after the lockout, but at this point, still, Sean Kemp is still pretty fucking solid, so.
Yeah. Next, we have the Knicks against the Heat, and this was the big surprise.
Nothing happened here, I'm sure. It's just a standard Knicks Heat. I mean, come on, 1998 Knicks Heat, nothing really happened, I'm sure.
Sure. Nothing... Not too exciting here. In fact, the Knicks are able to win in a bold upset to the 7 seed beating the 2 seed in this series. But there were some extenuating circumstances.
Yes. So building off last year's playoff rivalry, it was Charlie Ward and P.J. Brown got in a fight last year when these two teams faced off. And then things stayed pretty calm until Game 4, which is actually interesting. I think most people assume by Game 1, because these guys, like, hated. These teams hated each other. There was, like, weird internal beefs between just numbers. I mean, you had Pat Riley versus the Knicks. You had Larry Johnson and Alonzo. Like, you just had tons of stuff here. It was really, really weighty in terms of the amount of rivalries that you had. But Game 4, things got a little not great. So Knicks win 90-85, but the big story is the fight. Larry Johnson and Alonzo Mourning got into a fight in the closing seconds of the game, both through several punches, none really connected, but they will be suspended, then, both guys, for Game 5, and it became quite the ordeal there for that Game 5 fight, and it's a pretty famous fight as well in NBA history.
Yeah, of course, they had that association with each other when they were in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. I think SB Nation did a good their Beef History series. They did kind of a good breakdown of that situation. But yeah, so they did not care much for each other, and the Knicks were able to take advantage of Mourning, obviously the more important player.
Sure, although, absolutely.
Larry Johnson very good as well. Worth noting that Patrick Ewing was still injured, did not play in this series, so that maybe some. A bit of Ewing effect there for those who we've already kind of we've tried to dismantle that idea, but if you want to believe in it, there's your evidence right there. So
right, they yes, won. Exactly. Yeah. If Patrick Ewing was out and they won, ergo Patrick Ewing is bad. Yes. So or something.
And then the Knicks won Game 5 fairly easily, 98-81 in Miami. As of course, they were the Heat had lost their best player and were unfortunately unable to recover from that, mm-hmm. at least if you're a Heat fan. Which why would you be? But
yeah, right. Yeah. Top performance of the series, Tim Hardaway played really well. He scored 26 points per game, and he only had 18.9 in the regular season. So you saw him really step up in these playoff series. 6.6 assists per game, and he had a 58.9 true shooting percentage. Also shot 43.6% from three. So go Tim Hardaway on that. We should also mention Allen Houston. Now he was starting to emerge a little bit more, and once Ewing went down, they were kind of searching for that next guy up, and Allen Houston really became that guy, and particularly in this playoff series, 23.2 points per game, 4.8. Rebounds per game, 3.0 assists per game. But Allen Houston's starting to become one of the primary options on the team, and something we would see in the next few years of Knicks history. He would become sort of the de facto leader. He would sort of emerge as probably their top player over the next couple of seasons.
So next we have the Trailblazers and the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers being the third seed, the Blazers being the sixth seed. And it was the second straight year that the two teams played in the first round, and the result was identical, with the Lakers winning 3-1. The Lakers narrowly won Game 1, 104-102. The rest of the game, the Blazers winning Game 3 was slightly close. The other games were not super competitive. But Rich, what was interesting about this series?
Yeah, I think some interesting things here is the six consecutive years that the Blazers had lost in the opening round of the playoffs, which is pretty miserable and kind of hurts a little bit. Noteworthy games. I mean, there's not a ton here, but I think probably Game 1 is the one you're going to look at, because it was Portland's best chance to upset the Lakers. I mean, the Lakers came in definitely as the favorites here, with Portland as somewhat the underdogs. Would have been interesting to see if they won that Game 1, how things may have turned around a little bit. But the Lakers squeak by with a two-point win and then really pretty much don't look back for the rest of the series. Top performer is going to be Shaquille O'Neal, who was just an absolute beast around this time. 29 points per game, 11.8 rebounds per game, shot 65.3% from the field too, which is pretty remarkable, pretty tough to guard there. But Shaq giving the Blazers a lot to handle there in that first round.
Next we have the Spurs and the Suns. The Spurs being the the Spurs being the 5 seed, and the Suns being the 4 seed. So the Suns actually being a slight upset, I guess, in the situation. The fairly competitive series throughout. Most of the games were at least fairly close up until Game 4, which was a pretty big domination from the Spurs. But yes, this is the beginning of the Tim Duncan in the playoffs era, I guess you could say.
Yeah, no, I mean, Game 1 is probably the most noteworthy game of the series, not for anything that really happened on the court, I guess, in some ways, but it's a playoff debut for Tim Duncan, and he'd have, of course, many, many, many more playoff games after this, and he acclimated himself pretty well to playoff basketball. He had 32 points, 10 rebounds on 12 of 21 shooting, so Tim Duncan, pretty much from the moment go, from the word go, was ready to go in the playoffs. Top performers, I'm going to kind of extend this to a few people, the Spurs Triple Towers. Yes, it's a triple tower. Yeah, David Robinson, he has 20.3 points per game, 16 rebounds per game in this series. Duncan has 20.3 points per game, 9.8 rebounds per game. And of course, the Spurs' next biggest player. Oh, wait, no, it's Avery Johnson. Really small Avery Johnson. But he gave the Spurs 20.5 points per game on a ridiculous 65.2 true shooting percentage. I don't know what the hell got into Avery, but man, he was eating well in the series against Phoenix. That's a big explosion for old Avery there.
I'd forgotten how old the Spurs were at this point, because of their top seven players, all of them are older than 30 except for Tim Duncan. Got Avery Johnson, David Robinson, Jaren Jackson, Vey Del Negro, Chuck Person, and Will Perdue are all 30 and older. Most of them 32 and 33. Yeah, wow. So, yes.
Yeah, did that carry over the next year then, too? Because I'm trying to remember. I think they started including a few more younger guys. I know, like, Malik Rose got some playing time. Antonio Daniels started playing a little bit more. Yeah. I think they got a little younger the next year when they would, you know, of course, Crystal Ball win the title. Even though they brought in guys like Steve Kerr and whatnot and a few other older dudes. But sure. I think, all in all, they got a little younger.
We'll have to check that one in the future as we progress through here. Right. Yeah. We'll get to that. Let's not rush this, you know. Funny to think of Avery Johnson doing so well in the with Duncan Robinson there, but he absolutely delivered very well in the series. So, yeah, I guess the only other the Suns not really top player, but most notable performance was George McLeod shooting 12 of 21 from three in the series. So nice job by George.
George McLeod, yeah.
Yeah. So next we have the Seattle Supersonics, the second seed, taking on the Minnesota Timberwolves, the seventh seed. And the Wolves gave the Sonics a little bit of a scare, taking it to five games. And it's not like George Karl to have a difficult time in the first round against a lesser opponent.
No, not at all. Yeah, he's never, especially with his tenure in the Sonics, where they would always, I mean, you could always rely, especially if they were like the number one seed or whatever, you knew that they're not going to lose to an eight seed.
I mean, they're never going to outperform in the first round, no.
Yeah, exactly. That team, George Karl is nothing if not a master motivator that just gets his players and gets the most out of them on every given time. But this is a pretty interesting game here, or a pretty interesting series, I should say. Noteworthy game five. I mean, the Wolves give it their all. This is their franchise's second ever playoff series, and they were looking for their first, you know, of course, playoff series victory of all time as a franchise. Unfortunately, Kevin Garnett becomes kind of public enemy number one here because he struggles in the field. He has only 7 points on 3-11 shooting, and you know, they lose 97-84. They try their best, but yeah, it's like without Garnett being the real leader there, it's hard to do a whole lot. But the top performer for the entire series, Gary Payton, was really good in this series. He had 26 points per game on a little over 60% true shooting percentage. But they just squeaked by here. But you know, hey, I'm thinking things are good for the Sonics. This is probably the lone bump in the road for them. I think things are gonna go good. I mean, they just won like 63 games this year or whatever. I mean, they're good to go.
Yeah, they'll be fine. No problem at all. So, and last but not least in the first round is the Utah Jazz of the top seed taking on the Houston Rockets, the eighth seed, of course. And this one was a little tight. It went five games as well. The old man Houston team, Charles Barkley, Hakeem Olajuwon, and Clyde Drexler, the retiring Clyde Drexler, give it one last go, but they fall short to the the Jazz are a pretty old man team too, with the Malone and Stockton, and most of their role players are in their 30s. Well, Hornacek's 34, so they weren't exactly young spring chickens either, but of course Malone and Stockton were ageless and were able to pull out the series with a forceful win in game five.
Yeah, noteworthy. I mean, there's not a ton of noteworthy games that stand out here. Game three, just because it was a little close, Rockets win 89-85. So it looks like they actually have some control of the series. But then the Jazz win, of course, the next two to take it. Game five, of course, I think would be maybe the most noteworthy, just because it is Clyde Drexler's final NBA game. And unfortunately, the Jazz, they win 84-70. So he doesn't go out with a very good game there. Doesn't go out with a bang. What's interesting, not a top performer, but maybe a guy that you would hope would be a little bit better, but didn't really quite come to fruition. Charles Barkley, he only averaged 9 points and 5.3 rebounds per game in the entire series. So did not really do well for the Rockets. And yeah, things aren't looking great for the Rockets here.
Yeah, I would probably give a top performer to Malone, 26.6 points, 12.6 rebounds on 46% shooting, so pretty strong series for him. Olajuwon had some strong numbers, 20.4 points, 10.8 rebounds, and 3.2 blocks, but only shot 39% from the field, so not obviously strong. I don't know who's providing the rim protection there in Utah with is Ostertag like a really stout Olajuwon defender? I'm not really sure who's.
They just put a cardboard cutout of Mark Eaton there, and that's been helping. That's been doing pretty well, so it's been all right. They just got to move him out of the key every so often so he doesn't get three in the key, but otherwise it's been working pretty well. So
yes. So yeah,
the Rockets the Rockets aren't very fast, so you can get by with a cardboard cutout guy.
That's true.
You know what I mean? Like, the Rockets aren't really running up and down the court all that much.
Yeah,
so.
No, not so much. So yeah, so Barkley, yeah, he got a rough series because, as you mentioned, the struggles there. He also had a right torn right triceps muscle that kept him out of the final game, and he was out for 3 to 5 months. Although I guess that didn't matter. Spoiler alert with the lockout coming. And then he also was fined $10,000 for using profane language and making obscene gestures at a fan during one of the games. So I guess it's just Charles being Charles.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, so looking at some of the awards, we'll do the lesser awards here, then we'll get back to the playoffs and then do the bigger awards. Sixth Man of the Year was won by Danny Manning of the Suns, who earned 57 votes out of 116. Kobe Bryant had 31, Dale Ellis had 21, and Manning averaged 13.5 points and 5.6 rebounds. And there are a lot of threads out there about how Kobe was robbed of the Sixth Man Award. I just hope that we all realize that we have better uses of our time than trying to demonstrate. Even if right. It's true, even if it's true, and it's I would say the evidence is specious at best. But I would say that hopefully we don't need to really do this.
No, I mean, and I think Del Harris summed up pretty well. He had a quote, and it's an LA Times piece about the Sixth Man of the Year award, and he says, that's too bad about, Kobe not winning. He says, Danny was certainly a worthy candidate. Kobe's going to have a lot of time in the future to win a lot of awards, and I think he will. So, yes. That pretty much sums it up. Don't worry about this. Kobe's legacy would define itself, and I don't think the Sixth Man of the Year was really the one that was going to change anything all that much. And this is, as well for Danny Manning, who had battled a ton of injuries, an up-and-down career, whatever. I think this was a little bit more, to an extent, kind of a Lifetime Achievement Award for him as well. So I think, whatever. I mean, Danny Manning was good, and Kobe was fine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's okay.
Yeah. It's not like Danny Manning was a bad... I mean, he definitely deserved it, and Kobe would have been a worthy guy as well. But yeah, it's not like Danny Manning was just a terrible, terrible pick.
Right. And Harris points out that, Kobe was a little bit more in the spotlight, and he had, that stretch of, 10 to 12 games after the All-Star break where he really struggled shooting the ball, and that, was magnified more than anything that Manning was doing at the same time. So that obviously probably weighed in voters' minds there. But, yes, unfortunately for Manning, he ended up the next day after he won the award, he had a surgery to reconstruct his left knee due to a torn ACL and repair a torn MCL. So it was the third knee surgery of his career. And you might think this would have marked the end of his career, or pretty much close to the end of his career, but he actually played all 50 games in the next season and stretched his career to 2003. So mm-hmm. Go Danny Manning. He played longer than I thought.
Yeah, I remember him playing on the Mavericks and stuff. Yeah, I remember him lasting quite a while. So good for Danny Manning.
Yeah,
good
for Danny. Yeah, so... Rookie of the Year, Tim Duncan. Not really.
This is a hard one. Yeah,
surprise here. Yes, he managed to get.
I want to meet these. There's. Okay, you'll get to it in a sec. But I want to meet these people, and they need to show themselves. So
yes, right. 113. He got 113 of the 116 first place votes, and Keith Van Horn got the other three.
Come on. So his mom. who was voting for this? Was it were parents allowed? Because how do you? I mean. Maybe, I don't know, I'm not even looking at Van Horn's numbers. I don't care. Tim Duncan, come on, are you kidding?
Right. No, there's no, we have no idea who actually voted on these. Were not public, so, but they would obviously get roasted if that were the case now, beyond belief. But, yes, Duncan, he was also named to the All-NBA first team, was the first rookie to do so since Larry Bird, and he joined Ralph Sampson and David Robinson as the only players to win Rookie of the Month each month in the season, which was the award has existed since the 82 season. So, yes, the all-rookie team was Duncan and Van Horn, both unanimous choices. Brevin Knight, Zdrunas Ogoskis, and Ron Mercer also made the first team. So, two Cavaliers were on the second team also, because Knight and Ogoskis were Cavaliers. Also, Cedric Henderson and Derek Anderson also making second team. So the Cavs had four rookies on that team.
Yeah, this rookie team is terrible.
Yes. Z and Duncan were good.
Yeah, I see you have Tim Duncan. Yes, that's true.
Obviously Tim Duncan is more than just good, and Ogoskis was and Van Horn was good.
Van Horn was solid at times. We're joking about Keith Van Horn, but he was actually a pretty solid player.
He was a good player for when he played, but he just retired early.
For sure. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. And I have a tough time believing Bobby Jackson was ever young. I feel like he was always 31. Even on those Kings teams, even though it was 2000, even though he was 26, I just thought he was always 32. He just kind of played he was 32 all the time.
Yeah. He was indeed. So next, most improved, Alan Henderson of the Hawks got 33 out of 116 votes. Corliss Williamson of the Kings had 25, and Donyell Marshall of the Warriors had 24. So Henderson almost basically doubled his points average and increased his rebounds from six. From 2.1 more rebounds, I can't do the math right now, but up to 6.4 rebounds. So whatever 2.1 minus. Right,
we're not a math show. We're not a math podcast.
Yeah, no. Go to Dunkdown or something if you want math. So.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah, like Dana LaRue do it. We're not doing it. But this is an interesting one for Henderson here because he had kind of a weird career. So he was selected the 16th pick of the 95 draft, but he didn't play a huge role on the Hawks immediately because the team was pretty good when he came in and he came off the bench and they had a crowded front court as well. So he averaged only about 6 points per game his first two seasons. His rookie year, he was behind Andrew Lane, Grant Long, Christian Laettner, and a bunch of others. And the Hawks were pretty good. They won 46 games that year. His sophomore year, the Hawks jumped up to 56 wins, but Laettner had to move over to power forward to accommodate Dikembe Mutombo. So Henderson then was behind Laettner in terms of getting minutes. And then also a weird illness kept him off the court, which is going to be ironic here in a little bit. But after a promising rookie year, and this is a quote from my Los Angeles Times piece, after a promising rookie year and an outstanding training camp in 1996, Henderson contracted a mysterious illness that eventually was diagnosed as acute viral pancreatitis. He was so weak for a time that he couldn't eat or get out of bed. He lost 25 pounds before doctors diagnosed his condition, and that kept him off the court for 51 games. So that's his sophomore season, so not much doing there. Then his third year, Henderson starts the season pretty much in the same place that he was. The Hawks are still good. They brought back most of their team from the prior year. And then, in a weird kind of Wally Pip, moment here, Christian Laettner got the flu. And then after that, Henderson grabbed the job and really never let it go. He was chosen, of course, as the NBA's most improved player. This is from the LA Times piece, and this is a quote from Henderson. He says, "I was playing behind an all-star forward. I knew I would get a chance, but I didn't know when it would be or ever if it would be here." So Laettner came down with the flu on the February 10th game against Milwaukee. Henderson then stepped into the lineup, played 43 minutes. He scored 19 points and grabbed 15 rebounds. And then he really never looked back. They kind of rode the hot hand for almost the entire season. Laettner still, of course, got some of his minutes back, but they started integrating Henderson a little bit more from there. And this is the last quote from him. He said, "It's a funny thing. If Laettner had not gotten the flu, I'd probably still be running around saying, 'I can play, give me a chance.'" So ironic there is that an illness takes him away from his sophomore campaign, but an illness to Christian Laettner gets him back in the running there and gets a most improved player. So go Allen Henderson.
Yeah, go Allen Henderson. Yeah, that's nice little some nice detail about Allen Henderson. You're not going to get that from any other podcast.
Your foremost authority on Allen Henderson. Fun fact. Right. So there you go.
Yeah. Which is good. Yeah. So the only thing I remember about Allen Henderson was that he had like one of those really terrible early 2000s contracts that was like 7 years long and was, not much money compared to like today, but was like 20% of the cap or whatever. And crippled the Hawks for a while. It was like one of those kind of things where he could barely play and he had these, this terrible contract. So good times. Next, we have Dikembe Mutombo, Defensive Player of the Year, and this was his third time he was awarded the award, which made him the first three-time winner. And he had 39 out of a possible 116 votes. Gary Payton had 37, so came very close to winning. David Robinson, of all people, had 10 votes, was in third place. Not that David Robinson was a good defender, but he just sort of was a surprise to me slightly here. Of course, he was the distant third here. The award, only four other players had won twice: Sidney Moncrief, Mark Eaton, Dennis Rodman, and Hakeem Olajuwon. It is noteworthy, and of course, individual defense is hard to measure, and I believe that Dikembe Mutombo was a great defensive player, but the Hawks were only 13th in the league in defensive rating that year, so that's sort of an interesting data point there to wonder if maybe Mutombo definitely deserved the award, but obviously we're not taking away from him, so just interesting to note. Yeah,
definitely a good defender, and yeah, it's still to this day pretty tough to measure defense. I think we're doing a much better job of looking at that, but a lot of times in history, and even till almost recent history, a defensive player of the year meant like guy who gets a lot of blocks or guy who gets a lot of steals, and that's not to say the guy who gets a lot of blocks isn't a good defender, like in many times they are. A guy like a Ben Wallace was a tremendous defender, but sometimes people, one way or another, will just kind of default to a guy who gets a lot of turnovers, generated or whatnot, as always being a great defender. I think we've gotten better about it, but it's tough. It's hard award to really, you really got to study your film and your tape and whatnot. And sometimes these awards, people just kind of fill stuff out. And it's just, say that people don't do their due diligence, but not everybody does their due diligence before they.
Sure.
But not to take away from Dikembe. I'm sure he was great this year.
No, not at all. Yes, but I find that one interesting. So all defensive team, Michael Jordan becomes the first player in history to reach the all defensive first team 9 times, which obviously pretty incredible, but Michael Jordan, pretty good. We're willing to say that, I think.
I think so.
He had the most votes out of any player on this team, even more than Mutombo, who was the defensive player of the year. The first team was Michael Jordan, Gary Payton, Scottie Pippen, and Mutombo, as you mentioned, and Karl Malone, who was on the first team but had quite a few fewer first-place votes, votes in general. Pippen had 44, then Malone was all the way down to 24. He had the least amount on the first team. The second team was Mookie Blaylock with 23 votes, almost came there to the first team. I guess the positions there help. Eddie Jones, Tim Duncan, Charles Oakley, and David Robinson. So, and the one noteworthy thing to be is Karl Malone surprised you? Because I never really thought of him as a particularly strong defender. Certainly not a bad defender in any means, but I always kind of thought of him more as primarily offensive player, and just defense, like he was okay, but nothing special. But he did make four all-defensive teams in his career, including three times in the first team from 97 to 99. So, I don't know. Rich, what do you think of?
Yeah.
Did it surprise you?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I guess I never thought of him as like you said, as that great of a defender, even though he probably was, or at least, you know, it felt like it was. But yeah, no, he didn't. He just didn't really jump off the page to me as a guy that would definitely be, you know, an incredible defender, at least, especially in this age as he's getting a little bit older and starting to kind of slow down a little bit and understand his limitations. Because I think earlier in his career when he was super athletic, you could see it a little bit more. But yeah, I'm kind of surprised to see him on this list. And it was weird that he just got in by, like, you know, just a smidge. Like, it was not a whole lot to get him in there. But yeah, it was interesting to see him on there.
Yeah, I looked at Ben Taylor's piece on back picks. He recently did the 40 greatest players of all time series, and it's incredible. You know, scouting, video study, historical context, advanced stats, all that stuff blended really well. It's really awesome. Everyone should check it out if you haven't.
Yeah.
But I reread the Karl Malone one just to kind of see what he said about his defense, and it was more of like he was like a solid positional defender but could sometimes make mistakes and wasn't like was okay to good but not necessarily, you know, super, at least, you know, looking at the video study. So anyway, there's a pretty good authority on that as well. But nevertheless, a couple more awards before we get to more playoffs. Wayne Embry was executive of the year. He got 17 of the 29 votes, and I mean, The Cavs only improved just from 42 wins to 47, but they really basically revamped the team. As we mentioned, they had four rookies, you know, playing significant time, and they acquired Sean Kemp. You know, Zdrunas Gaskis was, you know, among their draftees. Obviously, he was very good this season and would continue to be an excellent player for them for, you know, another decade or so. So obviously, a good job for Wayne.
Yeah, you get four guys on the all rookie team, and you acquire an all star in Sean Kemp, and you improve in wins. That'll get you there for sure. Yeah, so go him.
And then the final one for now, Coach of the Year, won by Larry Bird, who received 50 votes. Jerry Sloan was second with 29. Mark Fitello had 15. This, of course, was Bird's first year coaching in the NBA, and he managed to win the Rookie of the Year as a player and Coach of the Year as a rookie. So, and then yeah, I guess he, which was sort of an odd thing to notice in this report about it, is that he joins Tom Heinsohn as the only Rookie of the Year and Coach of the Year winners, which I believe is still true. I cannot think of any coach, future coach.
Who else would be? Yeah, I'm trying to think.
Well, Jason Kidd, but he didn't win Coach of the Year. I don't
know. No, because he's a bad coach.
Right, right.
Right. So thank God he didn't win. Yeah. Good player. Not a great coach,
right.
But
no,
yeah,
right.
That's, yeah, I'm trying to think of anybody else that was. Yeah, we don't really, the days of like the awesome former player that turns coach is, I don't know, it seems like those have kind of gone away a little bit to an extent. I mean, you don't really necessarily get those guys. You get your, obviously, your Tyronn Lue types guys, you know, your sort of, you know, second tiered guys, you know, your Earl Watsons or whatever that became coaches. But yeah, I don't feel like, I don't know if it feels different. I don't know if it's like, I haven't done any study on it, but it does feel like those, because there was a while there where like top tier guys would end up becoming coaches, but it seems like that sort of died out a little bit.
Yeah, no, there are no, there have not been any winners since then, so we're good now.
There we go. Good.
Yes. So, right. Moving on to
maybe when Allen Iverson. Do we count Big Three coaching Coach of the Year awards or no?
I'm
sure, I was going to get that call every so often.
You know,
so.
Right. Yeah. We'll have to look into that.
One more shot.
One more pass.
One more block.
One more chance to risk it all.
Because in the playoffs,
you win one more time, or you go home.
The NBA playoffs on TNT and TBS. 40 games, 30 nights, everyone counts.
So next we move on to the second round, and we have the Hornets taking on the Bulls, and the Bulls handled this pretty reasonably handily, although it was a little bit there were a couple of harrowing moments, which we'll get to in a moment. But the Bulls win this series 4-1.
Yeah, noteworthy game, I would say, here is game two at the United Center, because the Hornets come here and they steal it with a 29-point fourth quarter. A pretty low-scoring game. The final score is 78-76, so not really a barn burner here. But, 29-point fourth quarter for the Hornets. Anthony Mason and Del Curry in that game tied for a team-high 15 points. So they were really the guys that led the charge there. But ultimately, of course, the Bulls win. And the top player is going to be, it's going to be Michael Jordan again, because he's pretty good. He had 29.6 points per game. But I'll give a little bit of credit on the Charlotte side as well. Glenn Rice had a really good series, 22.6 points per game, 5.4 rebounds per game, and 51.6 true shooting percentage. So Glenn Rice doing all he can to get the Hornets into the next round, but ultimately the Bulls move on.
So next we have the Knicks and the Pacers, and the Pacers win 4-1. Patrick Ewing makes his return during
see,
this
the
Ewing, series.
Yeah, there you go. See? Yeah, he was gone, they win. He comes back, they lose. I mean, that's all the evidence I need.
he missed most of the season, of course, with the injury, but did come back into to the series. Not his best didn't play all that terribly, but didn't necessarily play great here. Of course, whether the defense was there at after dealing with the injury and all that good stuff, who knows? But yes. So what happened, Rich?
Yeah, not a ton in the series. Kind of a boring one here. Probably the game that most sticks out, game two, because Patrick Ewing makes his return. He comes back. He does not play well. He scores only 10 points on 3 of 11 shooting. And unfortunately, his matchup, Rick Smith, scores 22. So there are more evidence of this Ewing theory, of course. But no, I mean, all jokes aside, Reggie Miller played really well this series, 24.6 points per game. But again, let's give it up Smith's. He finished the series with 16.8 points per game and 5.8 rebounds per game. I know he's kind of always, in some ways, unfairly considered just kind of like, I don't know, he's kind of laughed at it sometimes. I don't know, because it's like, and he was a good player, but people sort of look at him like, oh yeah, Rick Smith. I don't know. I always feel like there's jokes about Rick Smith. Maybe that's my friend. My friends are just assholes. But Rick Smith's a great player in this series and great player for Indiana at this time. A real deep Indiana team as well, who will move on to the Eastern Conference Finals.
Yeah. We'll see how they do there. Next we have the Lakers and the Sonics. The Lakers winning 4-1. You're going to set the theme in this round. And yes, the Sonics were able to take game one, but then it was Lakers all the way. Pretty dominating fashion, honestly. Game two was just a blowout, 92-68, and the rest were double-digit victories. So not the best showing from the Sonics there.
Yeah, and this is this brings in a question like the last great Sonics team. We'll again look at the crystal ball here, but they had won 61 games this year, but could not get back to the NBA Finals as they did in 1996. They'd missed the playoffs the following season and would have to wait until 2004-2005 to get this far into the playoffs again. So this kind of led, unfortunately, to a downtime in the Sonics, and we'll get to that here in a little bit. A noteworthy game, game two, Seattle wins game one at home, then gets destroyed by the Lakers in game two, that 92-68 game, as you mentioned, and then they wouldn't win again in the series. So they get that first win, and things are looking good, and then it just all comes crashing down, and then they get sweep out the rest of the series. Top performer Shaq was an absolute beast in the series, 30.6 points per game, 9.6 rebounds per game, and he shot 63% from the field. So yeah, not much stopping Shaq, but the real story is what happens after the series, the old Supersonics and our good friend Furious George.
Yes, George, he was fired on May 26th, day after my 20th birthday, 1998.
I'm sure you celebrated it. I'm sure that was a big talking point on your birthday, I'm sure, right?
It definitely was, yeah. We had a drink for old George. So, Wally Walker...
A drink? Sir, you were 20, sir. You were not old enough to be drinking yet, so I hope it was Orange Crush.
I'm bad at math tonight, so I was actually 19, not 20, but still too young to drink. So,
yes,
Orange
Crush in favor.
I was drinking Surge at the time, which is very popular. Yeah,
of course, yes. Surge rocks. Surge is the best. Yes. Tony Schiavone likes Surge, so I like Surge.
So Wally Walker, the Sonics president, said, "Our decision is based entirely on what we believe is in the team's best interest of going forward. It's not about money. It's not personal." But it probably was personal. It was a CBS News report that says the team's owner and Walker were unhappy with Carl because they viewed him as a loose cannon who leaked information to the media.
George Carl? No, get out of here.
Yes. And there's a quote from Wally. "I don't think George is about to change. I don't want to be in a position where I can't trust him to keep secret information that's very sensitive and can't get out." And apparently he deliberately did not tell Carl about the trade that brought Vin Baker to Seattle and sent Sean Kemp to Cleveland. So not necessarily ideal. And then and we're jumping ahead a little bit. That's okay. In June 17th, Seattle named Paul Westfall as their new head coach. So former – I guess he played for the Sonics very briefly and former Suns coach as well.
Right,
Paul Westfall – coming back. So
coming back. Things are going to go great. Everything's looking up. Things are going to go great.
And then our final series of the second round, the Utah Jazz taking on the San Antonio Spurs. And
let me guess.
The Jazz.
It went to seven games.
Went to seven games?
Yeah.
Not quite. Four games to one.
What the hell?
Every series in this round was 4-1. So not an exciting second round in general. The Jazz won a very, very close game in game one, 83-82. Otherwise, it was not a particularly, a close series for the... I take that back. Game two was actually fairly close as well. The Jazz won narrowly 109-106, and I guess they broke the Spurs spirit because outside of a game three win, they were unable to handle the Jazz.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting series. I think the most noteworthy one is the noteworthy game, rather, is game one, because San Antonio rides a 22-point fourth quarter, and they get within seconds of winning game one, as you mentioned, narrow game there. I don't know if the series could have turned, but looking at how close a lot of the games were, there's a chance that maybe the Spurs do upset the Jazz here. Of course, you know, they lose the first game by one. They lose, you know, the second game by only a handful of points. They win, you know, decisively in game three, and then, you know, the rest of the games are, you know, they're like 10-point losses or, you know, 9-point losses or whatnot. So maybe it couldn't change the things all that much, but it'd be interesting to see what could have happened possibly if the Spurs did win that first game. But it kind of maybe gives us a little bit of a preview of what was to come with the Spurs. I mean, they're obviously a good team. They're on the rise and they're gonna be here very, very quickly. Top performer Karl Malone, he has 24.6 points per game, 10 rebounds per game. But hard not to call out rookie Tim Duncan. Of course, we mentioned him a few times, but he led the Spurs with 21 points per game. So, Tim Duncan emerging. And, next season things should look pretty good for the old Spurs.
Certainly very likely, yes. So, now back to some more key awards. The All-NBA teams. Your first team is Karl Malone and Michael Jordan, who were unanimous. Tim Duncan, Shaquille O'Neal, and Gary Payton are your... are on your team. Tim Duncan by far had the least number of points for the first team. He had 370, and looking on the second team, David Robinson had 332. So it was very close to making a swap there if positions were not a factor, which of course they are. I've never really delved into the you always just kind of think of like, oh, this guy's first team, this guy's second team, but like not all first team are equal. I mean, you know, the voting totals of Karl Malone and Tim Duncan on this were very different here, which obviously kind of means something, even though in the end they both had the same award. So
right, yeah, we kind of a lot of times just chalk it up, and we do that pretty unfairly as well. I think we do a better job of not, you know, counting rings as our you know, one right thing when we talk about players, but we are guilty of using like first teams and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. And there's also like weird, interesting situations where, you know, like David Robinson, like Shaquille O'Neal also played with David Robinson. So David Robinson had an incredible year, but, you know, obviously Shaq, who was so much better than him, is going to be the top, you know, vote getter in the or one of the top vote getters, and obviously the top center vote getter. So yeah, it's interesting to see how those things kind of break down. And it's weird is I don't see Keith Van Horn. I don't see Keith Van Horn anywhere on that first team, but I see Tim Duncan, who somehow wasn't the unanimous rookie of the year, but somehow made it to the first team of the NBA. But, you know,
weird. I don't know. It's hard to say.
I'm squinting. I'm looking at the second team and third team. It must have been in air. I don't see Keith Van Horn anywhere out there.
Yes.
I'm sorry to Keith Van Horn. He's a very good player. I'm not besmirching Keith Van Horn. Let me just admit that.
I like his long socks. You know, they're pretty cool. So,
I liked him on the cover of the horrendous NBA Live game that was on N64, I think. So.
Yeah, there you go. So second team, Grant Hill, Vin Baker, David Robinson, Tim Hardaway, and Rod Strickland. And third team, Scottie Pippen, Glenn Rice, Dikembe Mutombo, Mitch Richmond, and Reggie Miller. I don't have any major objections here. A little surprised that Sean Kemp didn't make it, although I'm not, like, you know, clamoring that he absolutely should have made it. And I think that Reggie Miller probably deserved better than 13. But outside of that, not really. I didn't really see anything that super noteworthy that I objected to.
No, not much. I think Rod Strickland being pretty interesting there, but Rod Strickland was great at this time, so that definitely makes sense there. But yeah, pretty interesting. And then I think what's also cool too is Mitch Richmond, who started on the Kings and then got traded to the Bullets during the season. I forget if they were the Wizards at this point. I should know this better.
They were the Wizards, but actually he didn't play for the Wizards. He didn't play there. He was traded. I believe he was traded before the award was announced, but it was after the season.
Got it. Okay, I get it. Yes. Then that's why he was listed there. Okay, I don't remember him doing that, so that's why I thought it was interesting. So never mind. Regardless, Rod Strickland being on there, pretty cool. But yeah, I would say Reggie Miller maybe moving up a little bit, and then Scottie Pippen's a guy who I think probably deserves to be on there. But if you really look at his year that he had, it was a very up and down year as he had battled injuries almost the entire time. But he was a guy that'd be hard to not put him on one of these lists. But he's one that you maybe wonder if there was somebody else a little bit more deserving. And that's not to take anything away from Scottie, but he battled a lot of injuries this year. He missed a lot of time as well.
Yeah, I mean, he missed the first month and a half of the season. That stands out as well. That's a good point. So before we get to the big award, there is something called the IBM award. Had you ever heard of this before,
Rich? I had never until I saw this in the notes today, but then I spent about 2 hours looking it up. I think we're going to have to do an entire show on this IBM award at some point. But yeah, let's talk about it a little.
I agree. Yeah, we can delve a little bit into it here, but I think this warrants further conversation in the future. But so there's a statistical formula. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's math. Who wants to do that? But basically, it's you take your positive stats, add them together, and subtract them by your negative stats, and then divide them by your team's portion of the same stats. So the idea is like what percentage of your good stats minus your negative stats are you providing for your team? Is the basic summary. So this was given out between 84 and 2002. It was originally called the Pivotal Player Award, and it was sponsored by Schick, but it became an IBM award at some point, which actually makes much more sense as an IBM award.
Because it's like and if you read some of the articles from it, it was like, oh, a complex computer formula brings this award together, which is it's like basic, division and subtraction or whatever. But in the 1980s, when you mentioned computers were doing something, it was like, computer equation. That's why, we definitely have to talk about this more.
So
just if only to read the stuff about it is pretty fascinating. But yeah, I don't know why it wasn't always the IBM award. I don't know what Schick had to do with this like complex formula, but hey, go with them, I guess.
Hey, well, go with them. So the top 10 finishers are Karl Malone, Tim Duncan, David Robinson, Grant Hill, Dikembe Mutombo, Dennis Rodman, Anthony Mason, Michael Jordan, Gary Payton, and Rod Strickland. So Jordan 8th on this list. Which is a little shocking. Karl Malone with 99 points. Michael Jordan only 85 points. So obviously, Karl Malone should be the MVP.
I don't know why we don't IBM always just use the IBM awards. Yeah.
One
thing that I found kind of interesting in doing a little bit of research through this IBM award, and again, we definitely need to do an entire show, is that, and this formula is essentially like a pretty crude version of PER. And if you look at the leaderboards, it is pretty remarkable. Most of the PER guys, most of the guys that were tops in PER end up being tops in this IBM award as well. So it stays pretty in line with that award. But yeah, we'll have to definitely delve in a little bit more and see just how in line and how related those two are, and how related the IBM award is to MVPs and other stuff, because they are some weird winners for these IBM awards sometimes.
Yeah, I don't want to save this for the IBM award discussion, but the winners, we're not going to go through them because we'll do that later. But and usually they're players that you would think of that could be winners of this award. But 1992, Dennis Rodman winning the award for his year with the Pistons. That one stands out as an oddity. I mean, obviously we respect Dennis Rodman a lot for his great play, but being on this list and winning the award that year is very interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And Rodman, he shows up here too in this award over Michael Jordan, above Michael Jordan.
Yeah, so obviously,
obviously Dennis Rodman, much more valuable to the team than
I guess
Jordan.
The rebounds must
right,
be.
Right.
That, obviously, yeah.
And Jordan, at this time, especially, Jordan is not an efficient shooter at all. So I think the player points minus field goal attempts, which is a big part, is definitely one. And then, Rodman is gathering a ton of rebounds and also never turning the ball over because he just never possesses the ball for more than 10 seconds. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, he gets the rebound and then he just gives it to somebody else and then walks down the court and, does. Whereas Jordan's going to obviously have more turnovers. And so, and that's, one of the issues when you do an award like this. But a guy like Karl Malone, who possessed the ball a ton, it's pretty interesting to see there. It just definitely shows how efficient he was at this point and how efficient he'd be for the next few years as well, kind of the late career renaissance of Karl Malone.
Yes. And we get to the big one, the MVP award, and it is won by Michael Jordan, winning it for the fifth time, which ties him for the second most with Bill Russell. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has won it six times, and so second to him. And yeah, Jordan won it with 1,084 points. Malone was second with 842. Other notable finishers were Gary Payton with 431 and Shaquille O'Neal with 311. So I think Shaq would have done better had it not been for missing like about a month or so with injuries.
Right, right,
like,
yeah.
But, so, but yeah.
Pretty remarkable that he's as far as high as he is despite missing all that time. But yeah, it's I have no issues with those winners. I think everything's pretty solid there.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And yeah, you know, we've talked about kind of this year, I think, before. But, you know, I think Jordan Malone were both worthy. I think Jordan over Malone is totally makes sense, even if Malone's stats probably were slightly stronger. But.
Saturday at 3 Eastern, Lakers Jazz. Sunday at 2:30 Eastern, Pacers Bulls. The NBA playoffs this weekend on NBC.
So yeah, now we'll delve back into the playoffs and the exciting matchup of the, you know, we're really looking forward to this because these are, you know, I think the two teams, even though the Sonics were a very good regular season team, I think this is the two teams that we were kind of expecting to battle here in the conference finals, you know, the established, you know, Stockton and Malone, Utah Jazz, and then of course these, you know, awesome Los Angeles Lakers with, you know, Shaquille having such a great season and, you know, four All-Stars, and it's going to be a barn burner of a series, right?
Yeah, not so much. Yeah, the Jazz went 4-0. And that sucked. The Jazz were, like, struggling all playoffs. The Lakers are, you know, looking pretty solid. They got Kobe. They got Shaq. They got Nick Van. No, it just doesn't work at all. Jazz went 4-0. Not really any interesting games all that much either. I mean, some are pretty close. Game 2 was 99-95. Eventually the game winning game 4, 96-92. But really not much. I mean, I think the most noteworthy game is game 1 because it just kind of starts the series out on the wrong note for the Lakers. The Jazz win 112-77. It's just like, you know, just a real bad one. And Robert Horry is quoted after the game. This is a New York Times piece. It says, "No heart, no brains, no courage." So not happy. Tensions are pretty high. And yeah, things would not go well for the Lakers the rest of the series. Top performer is probably Karl Malone here. He arguably outplays Shaq. 30 points per game, 10.3 rebounds per game. But to give Shaq his due, he had 31.8 points per game and 9.3 rebounds per game. So maybe he did not play him, but Shaq still played well. But ultimately, the Lakers do not get any wins. They don't win a single game in this series. In the Western Conference playoffs, kind of a sleepers to get the Jazz to the finals. Kind of boring, even though, because their last year, I mean, in 97, they had an arduous trip to get to the finals. This, they kind of coasted in there. That hardly seems fair.
Yeah, it hardly seems fair. We'll see how it goes. Maybe you know, maybe they give them the advantage. They'll be able to you know, get some rest. You
I
know,
like
maybe,
this bet. I like where you're going.
Yeah,
I like your angle.
Exactly. Yeah, I think they're gonna take advantage of that. Absolutely. So yes, and the exciting series in this in these playoffs, the Pacers against the Bulls, and the Pacers taking the Bulls to seven games in a very tight and competitive series with lots of close games. There were three games decided by three or fewer points, and others that several, most of those were single digits. Only one real blowout was game five, the Bulls winning there. The rest of the games were extremely close. So, but yeah, the this is, again, the first time in a while that the Bulls have been challenged this hard in a playoff series.
Yeah, it's the first time actually since 1990 that the Bulls, this current iteration of the Bulls, this dynasty, I was pushed to an elimination game in the conference finals. So yeah, you got all the way to 1990 to find this. Otherwise, they had pretty well, you know, controlled the Eastern Conference, but they got close here. Most noteworthy game, I'd say, there are plenty in this, but I think game four definitely stands out. This is the famous Reggie Miller game winner after a slight push on Jordan, a little bit of a push off on Jordan. But hey, you know, Jordan would you know, not be one against doing push-offs, as we'll maybe find out soon. But this allowed Indiana to avoid a 3-1 deficit. 3-1 definitely series turns around here, but they get it to 2-2 with that game winner, and it really turned the series around as well. Of course, ultimately, the Pacers do not win, but yeah, they definitely put up a great fight here. Top performer, this is boring again, but it's Michael Jordan. He had 31.7 points per game and 5.7 rebounds per game, so yada, yada, yada. Normal Michael Jordan, you know, scoring 30 a game, yada, yada. But no Pacer, I thought this was interesting, averaged more than 20 points, Reggie Miller being tops of the team at 17.4. But this is a really deep team, though. You had Jalen Rose emerging. You had, obviously, Reggie Miller. Just a bunch of guys on this team that could all kind of contribute in a number of different ways. So it's a fun team. It's actually one of my favorite teams of this era, because there was, like, you know, five or six or seven deep, really, of guys on this team. But, yeah, ultimately, the Jordan, Pippen, and Rodman are just a little too much for them to handle.
Yeah. I would not have guessed the third leading scorer for the Pacers in this series, even though he's kind of like Mr. Pacer, you know, outside of Reggie Miller, of course.
Oh,
can you guess who it is?
Oh, man, Mr. Pacer. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, kind of this era anyway, so.
Why am I not thinking of it?
Yeah.
Why am I blinking on it?
Just Dale Davis.
Of course, Dale Davis. Yeah, I forgot about old Dale. Yeah.
That's all right.
I love this team. This team is awesome. There's a lot of fun guys on this team, too. It's just, like, really deep. You got, like, you know, it's a fun team. Yeah, I like this one a lot. Yeah.
Chris Mullin, Derek McKee.
Yeah, oh, yeah, Mullin, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But he didn't play a whole lot in this series. I mean, maybe after, like, 20 minutes a game, I guess. But I kind of would have expected a slightly bigger role for him at this point. But obviously, he's near the end of his career. But nevertheless. So, yeah. So... Yeah, pretty exciting game seven. The you know, the Bulls winning 86-83 in that one. Jordan with 28 points, although he was only 9-25 shooting, but 9 rebounds, 8 assists. You know, big game, and the Bulls are able to take the series and go to the finals against the very rested Jazz. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, some other fun stuff about this game seven. Michael Jordan, he became the all-time leader in playoff points. He surpassed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's mark in Game 7. And also, NBA fined Jalen Rose and suspended him for Game 1 after he left the bench while Reggie Miller and Ron Harper scuffled in that Game 1. The NBA also fined Ron Harper and Reggie Miller as well. So a little bit of issues there. But, yeah, for the most part, a really fun series. Really historic series as well. A lot of fun stuff going in there. A lot of big names in here in terms of, you know, your Kerrs, your Pippins, your Kukoches, your Reggie Millers, your Mark Jacksons, your Smith. I mean, it's classic late 90s basketball right there. Yeah. Your Bill Wennington's.
Yeah, your Dickie Simpkins. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
Your Fred Hoiberg's.
The Mayors on that team. Like a lot of classic late 90s guys
absolutely
mucking it up in the old Eastern Conference, and Game 7 being 86-83. Yeah. But still being a fun game, but nobody's
back
scoring.
When the Eastern Conference could be respected.
Right, yes.
All right, so before we get to the actual finals, we're going to get some get a little bit of news and talk a little about the NBA draft. So the Nuggets, not surprisingly, after being 11-71, they fired a coach, Bill Hanslick. Decided, not so much with that, which is seems reasonable to me. And also, on a bit of a sad note, of course, well, anyway, getting fired is a sad note, but the Clippers fired Bill Fitch after his fourth season with the team. They were 17-65. He was, at the time, the only coach to have coached in more than 2,000 games, and his 4 years with the Clippers were tied the longest tenure of the franchise. Jack Ramsey coached the Braves from 73-76. So,
it's weird that nobody wants to hang around, or nobody can hang around the Clippers. That's
Rich,
so interesting.
Can you name the four of the franchises that Bill Fitch coached?
Oh, I should know this. Okay. Oh, I feel really bad that I don't know this. All right, Bill Fitch. Oh my God, I should know. Was it Denver? It wasn't Denver, right?
It was not Denver. No.
Fuck. I'm already out. I'm out.
Okay, so he coached the Cavs first for, like, basically the entire 70s, and then he coached the Celtics for their first title.
I forget that Celtics era. I was never going to get that one. The Cleveland, I would never have gotten the Boston one. I forget that he did that. Won a title there too, right?
He won a title there, and then he coached the Rockets to their finals appearance in 86. And then in the early 90s, he could be four-track daily. He coached the Nets.
Okay, so I would never have gotten the Nets one. I would have gotten the Rockets one eventually, because I do remember I just did that article a few weeks ago, and there's him, like, yucking it up with Keem or whatever. It's pretty funny. Yeah, he's wearing, of course, Bill Fitch, as Bill Fitch would, you know, a very customary Bill Fitch suit in that picture as well. But, I would have never gotten the Nets. I do not remember the Nets Bill Fitch era whatsoever.
Yes,
but I don't remember the Clippers Bill Fitch era either, to be fair. So.
Yes. It wasn't his best era, obviously. And he finished – this was his final coaching stop. He finished with a coaching record of 9-44 and 11-06. So – which I'm pretty sure is still the most coaching losses in NBA history, and one of the most coaching wins in NBA history as well. Although he's now I think he's still in the top 10, but he's further down this list than he was at the time. Not in the Hall of Fame, despite and with the record, you might think, well, okay, maybe not so much to the Hall of Fame, but he was a great coaching innovator, and you know, and obviously coached some elite teams, and you know, almost certainly deserved it despite the record, especially for a lot of people who are in the Hall of Fame, particularly coaches, of course.
For sure, yeah, so, yeah. I mean, there's not really a high bar for coaches. So yeah, Bill Fitch should definitely probably be in there, but
I would think so. So Latrell Spiro, our friend, was in the news filing a $30 million civil lawsuit against the NBA for lost wages and damages. We don't need to go through the whole rigmarole again, of course, about what happened. I think everyone here pretty much has heard us talk about that extensively. So we'll just make note of that. And also, we have a trade, a big one. We alluded to it earlier. The Wizards traded Chris Webber to Sacramento for Mitch Richmond and Otis Thorpe. So big deal there, you know. Webber going to his third franchise in his career. He's still, you know, fairly young player, but he had some legal issues in Washington. So I'm sure that was part of the incentive to get him out of there. And Mitch Richmond had basically been demanding a trade for the entire season, and finally got one when the season was over.
The Webber one is a really interesting thing here. Of course, yeah, the Mitch Richmond thing is funny because we've been following that as kind of the season went on. But yeah, Chris Webber ran into a few issues there. He had been popped for marijuana possession. There was some ongoing investigations of some altercation that happened with him and Juwan Howard and a woman at one of the parties or something like that. So there was a lot of stuff kind of building up for Chris Webber. And he was kind of sent to Sacramento. I know he wasn't happy. I know it was definitely not a great, you know, environment for Chris Webber going to Sacramento, and nobody really wants to go to Sacramento. But things work out pretty well. But I think this is kind of interesting here. Wes Unseld, the Wizards general manager, his quotes. He said, "This is a deal we had coveted ever since I became general manager. I've always thought of Richmond would be a tremendous asset. We had to give up a tremendous player." He needs different words because he keeps using tremendous. In Chris Webber, to get him, Webber has done a lot for this team. And he says, "I understand when you do trade young for old and big for little, you're open to criticism, but we desperately needed proven leadership and someone to get you a basket." So definitely needed a leader and needed some score. Otis Thorpe is your leader. Mitch Richmond is your basket getter. Chris Webber, your young, tall guy for the two smaller guys. But hey, worked out. It worked out pretty well for Sacramento. I don't know about Washington, but
not great years for Mitch Richmond and Washington, unfortunately. But better things becoming ahead eventually. Took a little while, but better things were happening as well. So another notable thing before we actually get to the draft, the Kings, in addition, of course, to making the Chris Webber trade, they were able to sign their 1996 first round pick, Peja Stojakovic, to a three-year, $3.3 million rookie contract. He had been playing in Greece, so they're starting to put together some pieces that are going to become very important in their future.
Absolutely, yeah, it's looking good finally for a little bit for Sacramento. But yeah, they got a great player in Webber, and starting to get some other guys in the fold as well.
And the Raptors are making some moves before the draft. They trade Roy Rogers and two first-round draft picks, both in the 98 draft, to the Rockets for Kevin Willis. So another team trying to get some veteran leadership going on there. But obviously, we talked a lot about Willis during the season. He had a really good year for the Rockets, so it makes some sense to a certain degree. And the Raptors also, they signed Butch Cowder, to their coach, to a two-year contract after they'd fired Darryl Walker and Carter was named interim coach. So on to the draft itself. What stands out to you about the players that selected early on in this draft?
Two back-to-back North Carolina guys, Anton Jameson and Vince Carter. That's definitely pretty interesting.
And of course, the Raptors select Jameson and the Warriors select Carter.
Yes. Dallas selecting Robert Traylor, Milwaukee taking Dirk Nowitzki, and then deciding this will be a good trade, and it was good for one side.
Right.
One side is Dallas, of course, because Dirk Nowitzki is still playing, and Robert Traylor did not play very long. Ricky Davis, 21. That's really interesting. Oh, yeah, Michael Olowokandi was the first overall pick. Great.
Not great. For the Clippers, I think we've talked about this before. I know it was talked a lot about in the Jonathan Abrams book, on the one in, you know, the Preps or Pros guys. I forget the name of that book off the top of my head, but
oh yeah, what the hell? Let me get the name of it while we're talking about
yes,
it.
Yes, but he it's remarkable that he was given the experience that he had and the how late he came to basketball that he was able to play in the league at all, and much as actually like be kind of a solid defensive player later on in his career. You know, obviously you don't want that for go ahead.
Boys Among Men was the name.
That's right. Yes. So, but you obviously don't want that out of a number one pick, but, you know, it is actually, if he'd been drafted like 15th, it would be like an incredibly inspiring story instead of being like, you know, a cautionary tale of woe because he was number one in the draft.
Right. So, yeah. No. And I watched this draft not that long ago because it was up on YouTube and I forget it was maybe in anticipation of this year's NBA draft. So I was just kind of watching it. It's kind of to gather, you know, what the tenor around it was. And Olabekandi was, you know, to an extent, a kind of a surprise pick at number one. He had a great college career at the University of Pacific, which is a very odd school to go to. And the reason why is because he essentially didn't know and just like grabbed a book and was like, there, and called them. I was like, hey, can I come play for you? And they're like, yeah, sure, I guess. And then he shows up and it's like the 7-foot giant. I mean, like, it's just an absolute beast that it shows up here. And yeah, he'd only been playing basketball, I think, competitively or even at all for like 2-3 years before this point. So it's just nuts that he was able to get to this point. And like you're saying, even if he's drafted like 10th, you know, it doesn't even have to be, even if he's drafted 8th or whatever, it's still like, I think Olabekandi ends up having a pretty good career because he did have a pretty solid career, but it was the idea that when you get drafted number one, there's always that thing around you, that idea that, okay, you're our guy, you're a franchise savior. And people talk about his work ethic and whatnot, and he wasn't a guy that really was in love with the game at all. He just kind of played it because he was what he was, and he didn't grow up playing it, and he didn't grow up really loving it. So it was always hard to get through these guys or get through to him. And like, he was still solid. He was able to just kind of be what he was and be okay. But like you said, there was guys that would just come to, you know, I remember for years and years and years, the Clippers would bring in everybody. I know Kareem said like after like 10 minutes, he just quit or whatever, because I remember they brought Kareem in to try to help him, and he was just like, I can't help this kid. He's not. And it was just because maybe he just didn't have the same, you know, love for the game or drive to be the greatest that some of these other guys have. But unfortunately, that was always kind of the label on him, is that he was a bust. And I don't know if that's necessarily fair given, you know, his circumstances. This isn't a guy that was very highly touted. I mean, other than just his few years in college where he had put up really gaudy numbers. But there is some talent in this draft, though. A lot of talent after the Olabekandi. We kind of laugh at that. But Mike Bibby goes number two. Rafael Friends, who obviously had a great career in the NBA. Anton Jameson, Vince Carter, Dirk Nowitzki, who is still playing to this day. Paul Pierce, Bonzi Wells. Guys like a Matt Harpering, a lot of like kind of bench guys. Tyronn Lue, of course, shows up there. One of the big, an interesting note here, Felipe Lopez. I don't know if you remember kind of the hysteria around him, but he was supposed to be kind of like the next big thing coming out of New York, which was the thing for like 15 years until people just gave up. But every year there'd be like, oh, this is like Sebastian Telfair was another one of those. Like, oh, he grew up on the streets of New York, so that means he's good. And like, you know, and Felipe Lopez, you know, he was like a big high school player, went to St. John's, stayed in New York, and it was supposed to be the second coming, but again, like just wasn't quite to that level or whatnot, but he was another guy. Nazi Muhammad, too, showed up in the first round here, and he's a guy who only until like what 2 years ago was playing in the NBA somehow. So
right, go, yeah, exactly.
Go Nazi Muhammad, but
Jason Williams was seventh overall. With
of
the
course,
Kings.
Yeah.
Larry Hughes was eighth with the Sixers. You pretty much got the most notable. Of course, Tyronn Lue, number 23 with the Nuggets. It's important, and another Mr. Pacer, Al Harrington, at 25. So. You know, I don't know. I'm calling everybody Mr. Pacer, but I guess I am. So.
I like him. Yeah, a lot of talent in this draft, but it's always notable for the Olabekandi going number one. And yeah, I like that we have defended, because I always agree with that too. That he, you know, a bust in the sense that he was drafted number one, but it's not his fault that he was drafted number one. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. It's just if he'd been even if he'd been drafted like seventh, like
yeah,
he'd
nobody
be,
cares.
He'd totally be. It would totally have a different like frame. Like he'd be like this positive thing of this guy who like you know, was able to play in the NBA despite having you know very little experience. So
right, but, like Rafe LaFrenz goes number three, and I said he had a pretty good career, but like Rafe LaFrenz, I mean, for all intents and purposes, did not do much either. But nobody considers Rafe LaFrenz like a bust or whatever. You know, he had a few solid years and then kind of went away or whatever. And yeah, sure. Olabekandi was a much worse player than that. But like a guy like Robert Traylor also comes up because he got traded for Dirk. But I think you know had he not done that, it probably wouldn't have. But yeah. It's definitely it's a little unfair, but we've hopefully done a good job of defending him there. So
yes, so and we have some trades that were consummated either on draft day or the next day. The Denver Nuggets traded Tony Batty and Tyronn Lue to the Lakers for Nick Van Exel. So Lue not going to the Nuggets, going to the Lakers. I guess this is probably a good I don't know if we've mentioned it on the show, but the notable thing about the Lakers Jazz series, of course, is Nick Van Exel during a timeout where everyone is clapping out of the huddle. I think it was, he said, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's 1-2-3 Cancun was or 1-2 Cancun was the So he got shipped out, went to the Nuggets. Yeah, they didn't get a really good return for
him. No, I was going to say, I mean, Nick Van Exel's really good at this point, and Tony Batiste is, I mean.
Yeah, fine. Yeah, the Lakers didn't get much for him, you know, for a guy who was an all-star player. Yeah, that's...
It's going to hurt him. I think this is really going to hurt the Lakers. I don't know what they're trying to do here, but I don't think they're going to build a winner.
Yeah, they did have to trade. They did trade some talent away for financial reasons as well. Is especially going to happen with the lockout year where they're going to be in a financial crunch because of... Shaq's contract, and they're going to have to trade away some guys who, you know, were pretty good. And it actually worked out for them long-term because they were better fits for Phil Jackson. But, you know, they talent-wise.
So I thought I was right here because I don't remember Tony Batiste ever suiting up for the Lakers. And it is true, he did not play for them. He got traded, spoiler, during the lockout, he got traded to the Boston Celtics for Travis Knight. So, again, probably just trying to reduce money there because I don't think Travis Knight was making as much as Tony Batiste was.
And Travis Knight had gone from the Lakers to the Celtics, and not when they went back to the Lakers.
Right. They loved them some Travis Knight. And who didn't love
Knight? Did not love Travis Knight, yes. Of course, as we mentioned, the Warriors trade Vince Carter and cash to the Raptors for Anton Jameson. The Grizzlies trade Antonio Daniels to the Spurs for Carl Herrera and Felipe Lopez. So Lopez going to the Grizzlies, the New York sensation, going to do great there, I'm sure. The Jazz trading Nazi Muhammad to the Sixers for a first-round pick in 99. The Suns trading Steve Nash to the Mavericks for Pat Garrity. Martin, I don't know how to pronounce Martin. Is it just Mercep or is it I've seen that name but never actually heard that name.
I don't know. We'll go with Mercep, but sorry.
Mercep, okay.
Well, sorry. We don't actually know your name.
Yeah, Bubba Wells and a 1999 first-round draft pick that turned out to be Sean Marion. So that was a better trade for the a better trade for the Suns than you might have expected. And the Bucks traded Pat Garrity and Dirk Nowitzki to the Mavericks for Robert Traylor.
Yeah, so. that's gonna suck to lose Pat Garrity, man. He's a solid player. Definitely gonna hurt them. I was looking at Travis Knight for some odd reason because I remember this being the kind of a story about him. But yeah, do you remember that he was drafted by the Bulls in the first round of the NBA draft and they just renounced his rights, which I found pretty funny. I'm sure it was financially obligated because they would have to give him a 3-year contract and they were. Obviously a little tight on money because Michael Jordan was making $30 million. But he drafted 29th overall. So it wasn't like he was like a top 10 pick or whatever. But they just straight up renounced his rights and he would then go on at the Lakers. So kind of funny.
Almost like a burden I guess, at that point. But it's just funny to think of Jarrell Reinsdorf as being as cheap, though, even if there is a legitimate reason to do
it. Sure. Like this is definitely one that people use a lot of times as well for him. But it's like, well, no, they were paying Michael Jordan a lot of money. They, didn't want to. But and it was Travis Knight.
Well,
but they'll draft him then, because it's always weird. Like, I don't know if they would have drafted, somebody drafted him and they're like, he sucks, never mind. Like, I don't know. It's always kind of an interesting thing there, because that does not happen often, where they draft somebody and then just say, you know what, get out of here.
Yes. So, and here we go. The NBA Finals. The Chicago Bulls against the rested Utah Jazz. Both the number one seeds from each conference are a rematch, of course, from the previous season. And, it's a fascinating series for a lot of reasons because, of course, we know and we knew going in that the Bulls, this was going to be the last run high likelihood it was going to be the last run for this team going in. We expected George to probably retire after the series. And, of course, the Jazz, Stockton and Malone are both getting older despite being great. They're, this is kind of their... perhaps their last chance to get a ring and, of course, to, be the only team that would have beaten the Bulls in the finals. And the Bulls able to pull it out.
Yeah, it's one of the most iconic NBA Finals matchups of all time. Of course, Game 6 being the most prominent game in their iconic game. The iconic, quote, final game for Michael Jordan. We'll just ignore that ever happened, that Jordan's thing ever happened. He hits the shot over Byron Russell for the Bulls, second three-peat of the decade. As far as the series, I mean, Jordan had an incredible series as well, 33.5 points per game. Malone went 25 points per game, 10.5 rebounds per game. Stockton, 9.7 points per game, 8.7 assists per game. I think the most notable thing, though, one thing that is pretty interesting there is a lot of the games are tight. I mean, game one, 88-85. Game two, 93-88 with the Bulls winning. The Jazz win game one, I should mention as well. Bulls win game two by a slim margin. Then game three, the Bulls win 96-254. So a little bit of a blowout there. Then game four, the Bulls come back again by a narrow margin, 86-82. And that's what made the series so awesome. Is other than game three, you ignore game three, we'll strike that from the record. Everything else is like right down to the final moments. Game five, people kind of forget about this one too. The Jazz eke it out 83-81. And then, of course, game six, Bulls win by one, 87-86 on Michael Jordan's historic shot. But as far as going back to that 96-54 game, almost lopsided game in the history of the NBA Finals, and the 54 points by the Jazz is also an NBA record for fewest points in a game since the inception of the 24-second shot clock. So not great to do that during the NBA Finals.
No, not ideal. And as we talked about previous show, of course, the lowest point total had actually been set during the regular season was 55. So,
but this is when basketball was better, though. Jason, are you kidding? Oh, like, this is real basketball right here. This era right now is like got 54 points in NBA Finals. That's basketball, Jason. That's real deal basketball.
That is for basketball. I'm sure there's
these floppers being, now. Yeah, you
know, there was no flopping in this game. Absolutely. No. So, yes. So. So it was not it was bad. It was a very bad game. Outside of that, as you talked about, like an incredibly competitive series. I mean, every other game is 5 points or fewer. You know, several of them are within a basket, and so it, obviously, it seems like a series that it largely could have gone either way. But obviously, the Bulls and Jordan will it in the end, incredibly. One notable interesting thing about this series is, of course, during this whole situation, there is the this is and of course for you and I, but probably not for a lot necessarily for a lot of people here, unless you were around at the time. But during this whole time, there was a wrestling storyline being built between Dennis Rodman and Karl Malone in WCW at the time. Dennis Rodman had appeared multiple times for WCW. He'd wrestled, made a few wrestling appearances already. Karl Malone was new to this, but Dennis Rodman actually he skipped a practice to attend a live wrestling event. And there was a on-court incident that where Rodman and Carmelo, I think they may have been like running for loose ball or something, and they kind of like got tangled up, and they started kind of like got into a physical altercation, and there was accusations, I think, by Bob Costas at the time of them like playing that up for the sake of being able to make money in wrestling. So
right. Which, Bob Costas was not very interested in pro wrestling at all. He's definitely not a big fan of wrestling. Yeah, right. It's almost comical because like they're running back on the court and they like trip and then like they just trip over each other like four times on the way up to the court. It's one of the most like, and everyone's probably seen it if you know what we're talking about here, but yeah, they're just like very oddly rolling to the front of the court. And I think if I remember correctly that Rodman had skipped a practice during this point as well, maybe to do something with the wrestling. I forget what it was, but yeah, it was building up to Bash the Beach 1998.
Oh, yes.
Folks, so we'll,
that was in August. You do not want to watch that match. No. There are other Dennis Rodman wrestling matches that are worth watching, but that is not one of them.
No, so, definitely assume it was fun and then don't ever watch it because it was not.
I believe Rodman actually may have fallen asleep during the match.
Like, yes, he was slumped over the top rope, I believe asleep, so.
That's
don't watch it. It's bad. It's really, really bad. No, yeah. Really bad. Yeah. But Malone, I mean, if you want to see the chiseled pecs of Karl Malone, that is one opportunity to do so.
He actually like took it seriously and like tried to make it into something better than it was. So yes.
Dennis, we'll give not him so much.
I don't say a lot of nice things about Karl Malone, but I will say that. So.
Yes, he definitely tried. Numerous records set by Utah's low scoring in this. As mentioned, the 54 points is the lowest point total in NBA history since the inception of the shot clock. Chicago's 42-point margin of victory, the largest in finals history. We're still talking about that 96-54 game here. Utah's 23 points in the second half, back when basketball was basketball. The lowest in playoff history. Their 9 points in the fourth quarter was the fewest in finals history. And then 21 field goals made was the lowest in finals history. 21 field goals made.
Yes.
The previous record was 23 in 1955 when the ball was like oblong, like mush, you know what I mean?
Yes. not the best. But yes, it all came down to, of course, a thrilling Game 6, 87-86 win for the Bulls. Michael Jordan had, 45 points in that game, and incredible performance as well. Scottie Pippen was hobbled at that point with a serious back injury, not able to contribute much. And, of course, the other Bulls being, fairly offensively limited in, Kukoc performing, but otherwise, they were, they're not that kind of team. So Jordan, putting all that on himself and leading the team to victory with, a clutch. We've all, of course, seen the push off on Byron Russell and, hitting the eventual, game winner to clinch the series, classic moment and, classic way for Jordan to go out if we're ignoring the Wizards years, which,
which we should. We
probably should. Yeah.
Which I am all in favor of definitely doing. But yeah, no, definitely an iconic series, an iconic time to be an NBA fan. Highest rated NBA finals in history. Six NBC broadcasts between the Bulls and the Jazz. They average an 18.7 rating, which is pretty nuts. Here, the highest and the most watched NBA finals game, Game 6.
Of all time.
Yeah, of all time was Game 6, which averaged a 22.3 rating for viewers on a Sunday night. So I remember that being a... I remember watching it. I remember where it was. Yeah, it was like everybody in Chicago. Sure. I mean, there was no... like, I don't know what the market share was in Chicago, but my God, like, you could have heard a pin drop in the streets when this game was going on. The lowest rated and least watched finals is where we're kind of doing a juxtaposition here. 2003 NBA Finals, which averaged a 5.2 rating. So just kind of give you an idea there. 5.2 in 2003, 22.3 for this Game 6 in 1998. So
yeah, and even maybe more telling is in 98, 35.89 million viewers, and then in 2003, 8.06 million viewers. Now, this is Game 2, so it's not exactly apples to apples comparison, but just think of where the NBA was kind of on the radar in 98 versus where it was in 2003 culturally, and that is a stark shift in just 6 years, five years. Mm-hmm. So I'm really bad at math today, today for whatever reason.
That's not what we're supposed to do. You know what, hey, that's not us.
Yes. So a few news and notes after the season before we get to the lockout. Phil Jackson's attorney confirmed that Jackson rejected an offer from Chicago to coach another year, so any kind of any kind of hope that he might come back and they might bring the band back together pretty much ends right there. And there's some and then the next day he resigns as head coach for the Bulls officially. So and in late June there are negotiations over a new collective bargaining agreement between the players union and the league, but unfortunately those stall. In June 29th, the union files a grievance on behalf of 220 players with guaranteed contracts in anticipation of them being denied paychecks. And then before we get to July 1st, one other bit of notes. The New Jersey Nets, just under the deadline, they reach a agreement with a group of businessmen to sell the team. The deal still needs to be finalized and then approved by the Board of Governors, which I think happens after the lockout. I'm not sure if they, I mean, I guess they can conduct business during the lockout, just the players cannot. So not really super important. I'm sure we'll get to that at some point. But
hopefully the Swamp Dragons are finally coming. Yeah, hopefully this will give us the Swamp Dragons, which is what we've all wanted from the New Jersey franchise.
So July 1st, the lockout begins. That means that teams can have no contact with players, no players can be signed, no trade can be made. Team workout facilities are closed to players, and NBA-sponsored summer leagues are canceled. So,
yeah, a lot of interesting stuff here. There's a great article. I don't want to read all of it. I'll let you guys look it up. But if you look it up, it's from June 30th, New York Times. It's just called Basketball, It's Their Ball, and NBA Owners Call for Lockouts. But essentially, it just kind of relays. We've been talking about it a lot as a series. It's been building and building and building and building. But there's some details here, some concrete details of what the issues really were. I'll read the first few paragraphs. Just kind of give you the idea. September 1995, Commissioner David Stern announced the signing of a six-year collective bargaining agreement that was supposed to preserve labor peace into the next century. When I initially read that line, I was like, what are they talking about? Like, oh yeah, it's like 1995, the next century was 2000. I kind of forget that, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm so used to living in this era that we are now. I was like, next century, what are you talking about? And it makes sense because it was going to be the next century. But a three-year out clause enabled the owners to renegotiate the contracts, the contract of the collective bargaining agreement, if player salaries exceeded 51.8% of basketball-related income. And then with a number of $100 million deal signed over the last 2 years, the salary figure reached more than 57% this year. So on March 23rd, the owners voted 27 to too, which, I mean, I get what they're doing there, but isn't that kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy? Like, ah, if we pay, if the players make too much money, we're going to lock out. It's like, well, you control that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, don't sign them to deals then if you're really worried about that. But, you know, it's this whole lockout's bizarre. But, yeah, that's yes. It's like, oh, if these players end up making more, then we'll lock out. Like, oh, they make more. It's like, well, yeah, but you were the big reason why that happened, right? Like, you controlled that. To me, I just find it funny that they, like, blame the players again for all this. And it's like, well, you signed into these contracts. Like, it's your fault, right? Like, I mean, you just not pay Kevin Garnett $120 million. I mean, you don't have to and complain about it, but it is what it is. But during the lockouts, as mentioned, yeah, none of that stuff's going to happen. A few things that they were looking to do. One note, charity games will still be allowed, and we'll talk about that more in later months here. But the owners have proposed that no player can make over 30% of a team's total salary cap, meaning the highest paid player in the league would average about $10 million under the new rules. 13 players now make more than that amount this season, so that'd be a drastic reduction. Yeah, to have 13 players, you know, already right now making over the threshold that they really want. There's always some worry as well about the Bird exemption and how some players, like Michael Jordan, gets $30 million because of the Bird exemption. But really, again, like young phenom like Kevin Garnett is always mentioned here, gobbled up $126 million yes. over 7 years. That greedy, gobbler, yeah. Kevin Garnett.
He's very greedy. Right? Like, greedy gobbler, yep.
Like, how dare he sign our blank check or what? It's really weird. But, yeah, so at the end of the... So the owners have made a proposal for a 5-year rookie scale. So the first 3 years of which would be guaranteed by the team. And then after that first year, a team would have right of first refusal in order to keep the player. The current 3-year rookie scale allows players unrestricted free agent after their third season. So one quote here by David Stern, and then we'll move on here. We think the potential revenue generation capacity in the NBA is healthy. It's the system that doesn't work. We can't afford to affect play. We can't afford to affect play the season under the current system. There are a number of clubs will do better not operating than operating. So he's basically saying that the teams would do better by not playing than playing, which is bizarre. So he says it's something the players do not seem to understand. And I think you are lying, David Stern. That I do not believe that is true, that some teams make more money by not playing than playing. But maybe. I don't know. But
I as we talked about a lot, there are a lot of creative accounting ways you can do, and I'm not
to this day saying, still to this day. Yeah, right? Like, oh, yeah. No. And it's like, oh, wait, what about that gigantic check you got from the NBA? Like, oh yeah, about that. But whatever, who cares about the NBA TV money and all the TV deals? We have no money. Like,
right? Yeah. Exactly. So
look at how much these players make.
Like, right? Yeah. How dare Kevin Garnett make us, you know,
gobbling up
sign up this contract, gobble up that all that money? Yes,
greedy anyway, gobbler. But
but you know, I'm sure it's not gonna last very long. It probably won't go into the season.
David sort of is nothing if not a man who is willing to take a few pegs down to make sure that the betterment of the game is definitely at the foremost.
Absolutely not.
And so, Billy Hunter too. Yes, it's great to go. Billy Hunter and David Stern, they're like, you know, those dudes.
Yeah.
Very close relationship. So I'm assuming this should go quite well.
So officially, Kenny Anderson of the Celtics becomes the first player to miss a paycheck when he has not paid his schedule $5.8 million. Yeah, I guess I don't know if that stinks. Was all like one. Yeah, that was like one lump sum or how that goes. But yes, so that is lockout history. So I'm sure Kenny was glad to make that history.
You know, first be the first one.
Yeah. So yes. So that's it. We're locked out. Nothing officially to report. We're we're done with basketball for the foreseeable future. So we'll see how that goes.
Things are gonna get a little weird. We got the intercontinental. I'm thinking wrestling. This international competition coming up.
intercontinental title tournament. You know, it's going on in 1998. You know,
I'm sure. I think it was. Yeah, I think it actually was.
Yeah. I think it was a little bit later. But yes, it was that year. Yes, September, I believe. So.
Yeah.
Yes. X-Pac was screwed by with Ken Shamrock.
I believe so.
The
dungeon match between Ken Shamrock and Owen Hart and Stu Hart's dungeon.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Exciting stuff. Yeah, that was a good one, actually. Yeah, that was right around this time, too, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. So nice in reference.
Yeah. Nice.
Sable won the bikini contest. That was cool.
Yeah, that's good. Yes. Are we just going to read the results of Fully Loaded 98?
I'm just gonna basically, I'm basically going down the list. Undertaker
there we go.
And Steve Austin defeated Kane and Mankind in the main event. I actually knew that. I'm not actually looking at the Wikipedia. I'm that much of a freaking nerd.
Yeah.
I think I may be able to recite that entire card, but I don't want to because you are our basketball people and you don't know about that other life that we have.
Was there a Val Venus and D'Lo Brown match on that show as well?
Yes.
Wasn't it 2 out of 3 falls, Rock and Triple H?
There was, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I probably know more about wrestling in '98 than I do about the NBA '98. To be honest, but so
again, that's a life that we don't want these people to know about. So
no, we don't.
So yes, I was reading on Wikipedia. Yes, I don't know anything about wrestling. Whatever.
Right.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just know about that Karl Malone and Dennis Rodman thing. Bash at the Beach. Yeah, hey, that's cool. Yeah.
There you go. So
can you believe Goldberg only was in a battle royal at Bash at the Beach? I mean, he just won the title like days prior, and he's in a freaking battle royal. He doesn't. Okay. Oh yeah. Sorry. It's another podcast. Sorry.
Yeah. So actually, I believe that he beat Kurt Hennig at Bash at the Beach. I believe it's Road Wild where he was in the.
Oh, you're right. God in the battle damn royal. It, you're so. Right. Yes.
So this took a strange turn, but it's not unusual for this show. So anyway. Thanks everyone for checking us out. Hopefully you have enjoyed the 20 years ago series. Sorry for being a little late on it, but we caught ourselves up. We're in July now, so we feel good about that. And if you like what we're doing, you can let us know on Twitter or Facebook at Over and Back NBA. Also, if you want to leave us a rating and review on iTunes or wherever, we're pretty much on every platform where you can listen to podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, all that good stuff. So find us there, leave us a rating and a review, and we would greatly appreciate it. So until next time, thanks. We'll be back again soon.